Welcome to the podcast. I'm Angela Beaubier, and this is Life in the Talbot Settlement, brought to you by Tyrconnell Heritage Society, operators of Backus Page House Museum. In this series, we will do our best to give you a full appreciation of the history of Western Elgin County in southwestern Ontario, from First Nations to the early settlers to the 1950s. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge funding from Tyrconnell Heritage Society, operators of Backus Page House Museum. Welcome to the 50th episode of the podcast, Life in the Talbot Settlement. On October 30th, 1941, the residents of Lawrence Station and surrounding area awoke to a thunderous noise followed by intense light. This phenomenon created quite the spectacle. Those who went out to investigate would soon discover the worst Canadian aviation crash of their time. And before we begin, I do want to mention that a play will be happening April 14th to 15th, 2023 at the Southwold Keystone Complex in Shedden, April 22nd, 2023 at the Gemini Sportsplex in Strathroy, and April 28th to 29th, 2023 at the Manor Park Memorial Hall in London. And it's a play written by Len Cuthbert, directed by Adam Corrigan Hollowitz. And you can get tickets at onstagelive.ca. So Lawrence Station is a small hamlet located within Southwold Township in Elgin County. It sits about 14 miles southwest of the once bustling railway city of St. Thomas. The hamlet was founded in 1843 by William Lawrence, a carpenter by trade and developer by heart. Once the Great Western Railway came through, William decided to donate 10 acres of his land for a depot. Since then, the town grew in population, along with it coming general stores, hotels, hardware stores, blacksmiths, and much more. Over time, and with the disuse of train traffic, Lawrence Station dwindled in numbers and businesses. In 1941, Lawrence Station had about 100 residents. The townspeople were no strangers to the sight and sound of airplanes flying overhead. Students training at the RCAF Bombing and Gunnery School, located in Fingal, took frequent trips all over southwestern Ontario. Not only were bombers routinely flying overhead, but commercial airlines also used the route. This route, over top Lawrence Station, was known as Green Airway No. 2. It was used so often, American Airlines would make 16 trips on that route in a span of 24 hours. And in case you hadn't realized it, this is World War II era, which is why there were students training at the RCAF Bombing and Gunnery School in Fingal. The flagship Erie was a DC-3, all-metal, low-wing monoplane manufactured by Douglas Aircraft Company in Santa Monica, California. American Airlines acquired the plane in 1940. After purchasing the aircraft, it was equipped with the newest technology and instruments of the time. This plane was one of the largest all-metal twin-engine transports of the World War II era. The plane was sported with two Pratt & Whitney 1,100 horsepower, nine-cylinder WASP engines. With a cruising speed of 185 miles per hour at 10,000 feet, the flagship Erie was at the top of its game. On October 30, 1941, just after 9 p.m., American Airlines Flight 1 departed Buffalo Municipal Airport en route to Detroit, Michigan, in its second stopover of its New York to Chicago run. About an hour later, that same flight would be burning in an oat field. Before departure, the plane had been topped up with 117 gallons of 90-octane fuel and 18 quarts of oil, making a total of 507 gallons of fuel and 160 quarts of oil. This was an ample amount to reach Detroit. Captain David Cooper proceeded with the usual pre-flight checklist, checking the controls, ailerons, elevators, and rudder, and yanked the wheel chocks away. After the checklist had been gone through, Cooper received the all-clear to taxi to the run-up area beside the runway. At 9:03 p.m., the Buffalo control cleared the crew for takeoff. At a rate of 500 feet per minute, the aircraft met its cruising altitude in 8 minutes. On board were 17 passengers and 3 crew members. The plane had a maximum capacity of 21 passengers, meaning four seats remained open on flight one. To Captain Cooper, this route was routine. He had flown the AM7 route multiple times for a year and a half. The lights of urban areas illuminating the path had become a regular sight. Cooper, a journalism graduate from the University of Syracuse, got his pilot's license in 1930 at Amboy Airport. Cooper later became a partner of the Cooper Anderson Air Service, which he started with an aerial photographer. After taking the airline pilot's course in 1934, Cooper became a co-pilot on the Newark to Buffalo route, mainly flying DC-2 and DC-3 aircraft. After accumulating around 6,000 hours, he was promoted to captain and became chief pilot of the Syracuse to Boston route. On American Airlines Flight 1, Officer Richard Owens sat next to Captain Cooper, co-piloting his very first transport trip. Before being employed by American Airlines in August of 1941, Owens worked as an instructor at various civilian flying schools. At American Airlines, Owens learned the controls of the engine, propellers, radio, fuel systems, and autopilot. He finished with a total of 22 hours, flying as third member of the pilot crew on DC-3s. Officer Owens completed his course exams October 29, 1941. And the next day, he was designated as a first officer and received his gold wings. The flagship Erie continued steadily at their altitude. The estimated time of arrival in Detroit was 10:47 p.m. The pilots relaxed, passengers talked amongst themselves or read magazines after stewardess Mary Elizabeth Blackley made her rounds supplying a light supper. 30 minutes in, the flight experienced some light rain, which was expected as it was forecasted for southwestern Ontario that night. Though the rain was light, water regularly leaked through the windshield frames and side windows of D3 airplanes. In London, Ontario, meteorologists reported a visibility of 2 miles with light fog, drizzle, and low cloud ceilings. Due to this, Canadian Air Forces suspended night flights and airports delayed trips. At 9:42 p.m., the flight reported that it had passed over the Jarvis radio range at 9:39. Captain Cooper advised them that the plane was steady at 4,000 feet and the weather was fine. This report was picked up by Jarvis, Strathburn, Buffalo, Detroit, and Chicago. Ross Connor, an operations staff in Detroit, acknowledged the message and gave Captain Cooper clearance to continue on to Detroit. A consensus was made that once Flight 1 had landed in Detroit, it would then be decided if the plane would continue to Chicago or be delayed from the weather conditions. Connor logged the last time he communicated with the flight at 9:44 p.m. Next, you'll hear an excerpt from the book Final Descent, The Loss of the Flagship Erie. 7-year-old Beth Turner and her 5-year-old brother David were awakened by their father shouting downstairs. He had rushed in from the barn to tell their mother there was a big fire over Lawrence Station. Jumping out of bed, the youngsters ran to their parents' bedroom window and peered out. Clearly visible to the north were flames leaping high into the night. The blaze presented quite a spectacle, especially when combined with the light ground mist presented that night. Despite reduced visibility, the fire could be seen as far away as St. Thomas, Canada's busiest railway junction, 14 miles to the east. Just after 10 p.m., Flagship Erie crashed in an oat field. In the process, nearly clipping the roof of Viola and Thompson Howe's house, 200 meters away. Fuel tanks ruptured upon impact, causing flames of 200 feet, scorching oat stubble surrounding the aircraft and sending rubble around the field. The plane reportedly fell from a height of around 500 feet, diving nose first into the earth. Viola immediately called the Shedden Central switchboard operator to get a hold of the RCAF and the police. In minutes, authorities were rushing to the wreckage. Lawrence Station was a close-knit community, and families hurried to the accident to try and help. Unfortunately, the heat was so strong it drove back the civilians. Not a soul appeared to be alive. 20 minutes later, 3 officers from the Fingal Bombing and Gunnery School sectioned off the area. Soon after, 20 police officers, including 2 Royal Canadian Mounted Police, arrived. The Mounted Police and Customs officers would temporarily take the wreckage. Meanwhile, back in the States, Ross Connor became concerned. He had not received a signal from the flight that it had passed over Florence. Connor's radioed Flight 1 at 10:38 p.m. and cleared it to make an approach to the Detroit Flight Tower, but no response came. To no avail, Connors tried over and over to get a response. And little did he know, the plane had already crashed at Lawrence Station. Lifeless, charred bodies scattered around the wreckage. The smell of smoke and burning flesh filled the air. That fateful day of October 30th, 1941, claimed 20 lives. 17 were passengers and 3 crew members. Many leaving behind significant others, family, children, and friends. 5 separate funeral homes were notified that they would be receiving and processing 4 victims each. The crash quickly made the headlines, and soon the story would be plastered on the front page of nearly every major newspaper in both Canada and the United States. That night, family members of those on Flight 1 awaited their arrival at both the Detroit and the Chicago airports. They would soon receive news of the tragedy, some being notified that the plane had simply been grounded and had not yet arrived. Later, families would receive phone calls informing them of the crash, while some found out on the radio. In the book Final Descent, The Loss of the Flagship Erie, which we have for sale in our Backus Page House Museum gift shop, the brother of John Kay, a passenger of Flight 1, recalls how he learned of the incident. Quote, "I went to the airport and waited, but my brother never came. Then we heard on the radio that the big airliner from Buffalo to Detroit had crashed and that all 20 persons on board had been killed. It was a shock a person doesn't care to experience more than once in his life," end quote. By 12:30 a.m., the Civil Aeronautics Board in Washington, D.C. was notified of the accident. They immediately launched an investigation as per protocol. Since the crash took place in Canada, the board had to get approval before they could arrive to investigate. Once it was granted by the Canadian government, 20 CAB inspectors and American Airlines engineers headed for Lawrence Station. The Howe family house quickly turned into a meeting place for the police, airline officials, and the investigators. Viola graciously provided the men with meals. One day following the crash, the Howe's house received a grim phone call. This call was from the sister of Captain David Cooper, asking if there were any survivors. Viola Howe had to regretfully inform her that all 20 people on board had been killed. Captain Cooper's body had been discovered buried in the ground amongst the wreckage alongside Officer Owens. Both died at their post, buckled, with hands on the controls. The following days, family members, dentists, friends, and employers traveled to St. Thomas to identify the bodies. If you're wondering why they sent dentists, you can usually identify somebody from dental records. That's why the dentists were there. They met at the St. Thomas courthouse, where they were then one by one escorted by police to the funeral homes. By Saturday evening, all 20 victims had been identified, the last 2 ruled out by a process of elimination. The next morning, Sunday, November 2nd, 1941, the bodies were loaded on freight cars and transported to their final resting places. This was the worst crash in American Airlines history at that point in time, and was the first fatal accident of the seemingly invincible DC-3 aircraft. Investigators in both Canada and the U.S. quickly began their inquiries. One possible cause included a flock of geese striking the plane. This was researched extensively. Around 200 military personnel from Elgin County were tasked with searching the area for the remains of a goose. They worked tirelessly searching a vast area for something no one knew for sure even existed. Unfortunately, nothing turned up. Despite lack of evidence, the birds have been popular prime suspects. For a few weeks prior to the crash, pilots all over the area were reporting bothersome migrating geese. One pilot at the Fingal Bombing and Gunnery School returned to the base with a hole in his bomber after being struck by the Canadian bird. No plane parts were found along the flight path, indicating that no equipment failed or fell off. Due to the fire damage, control settings could not be identified, causing technology failure to remain a possible cause, yet an undeterminable one. Following inspection, nothing suggested that the autopilot malfunctioned in flight. Though autopilot had developed years before the crash, in 1941 it was still in its early stages compared to modern autopilot technologies. Though no cause was determined, all witnesses agree. First, that attention was drawn to the plane because of the unusually loud engines. Second, the plane seemed to be in trouble based on the abrupt banking and circling at low altitude. And lastly, the circling was banking steadily 45 degrees, and it appeared the pilot was trying to bring the nose up. Some testified that no landing lights or flares were employed during the descent, while others claimed upon seeing such lights. All eyewitnesses did not offer any opinions as to why the crash occurred. However, their testimonies were crucial for the investigations towards determining the cause. With Canada enveloped in the Second World War, the plane crash quickly faded from memory. The event preceded the attack on Pearl Harbor and America's entry into World War II by less than 6 weeks. A commemorated plaque would mark the site nearly 78 years later on September 9, 2018. The tragedy remains a mystery to this day. Everything from a bird strike, failed autopilot mechanical issues, and lightning have been considered, but no definite conclusion has been made. Though the investigation failed to determine the cause of the accident, it led to the installation of flight data recorders. If you liked this episode, we suggest you read Final Descent, The Loss of the Flagship Erie, written by aviation historian Robert D. Schweier. Robert interviews residents of the area, examines evidence from the scene, and sheds light on the impact the fateful crash had on the residents of Lawrence Station and family members of victims. You can purchase the book for $20 in the Backus Page House Museum gift shop. Again, thank you for listening. Share the podcast with your friends and follow us on all social media platforms at Backus Page House. The Backus Page House Museum and Turconnell Heritage Society acknowledges the land we are on today as the traditional territory of First Nations people. As settlers at a settler-focused museum, we value both the significant historical and contemporary contributions of all original peoples and ask how we can be supportive in Indigenous cultural renewal. Life in the Talbot Settlement is a production of Turconnell Heritage Society, operators of Backus Page House Museum. Your host has been Angela Bobier, music provided by Jack Whitmer, and thanks to our producer, Caitlin Rietzma. To make a charitable donation, become a Turconnell Heritage Society member, and to contact the Backus Page House Museum, please visit our website, www.backuspagehouse.ca. Thank you again for listening.